The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. All Life is Yoga. Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works. Chapter 2, Self-Consecration, page 69. All yoga is in its nature a new birth. It is a birth out of the ordinary, the mentalized material life of man, into a higher spiritual consciousness, and a greater and diviner being. No yoga can be successfully undertaken and followed unless there is a strong awakening to the necessity of that larger spiritual existence. The soul that is called to this deep and vast inward change may arrive in different ways to the initial departure. It may come to it by its own natural development, which has been leading it unconsciously towards the awakening. It may reach it through the influence of a religion or the attraction of a philosophy. It may approach it by a slow illumination or leap to it by a sudden touch or shock. It may be pushed or led to it by the pressure of outward circumstances or by an inward necessity, by a single word that breaks the seals of the mind, or by long reflection, by the distant example of one who has trod the path, or by contact and daily influence. According to the nature and the circumstances, the call will come. But in whatever way it comes, there must be a decision of the mind and the will, and as its result, a complete and effective self-consecration. The acceptance of a new spiritual idea force and upward orientation in the being, an illumination, a turning or conversion seized on by the will and the heart's aspiration. This is the momentous act, which contains, as in a seed, all the results that the yoga has to give. The mere idea or intellectual seeking of something higher beyond, however strongly grasped by the mind's interest, is ineffective unless it is seized on by the heart as the one thing desirable, and by the will as the one thing to be done. For truth of the spirit has not to be merely thought, but to be lived. And to live it demands a unified, single-mindedness of the being. So great a change as is contemplated by the yoga is not to be effected by a divided will, or by a small portion of the energy, or by a hesitating mind. He who seeks the divine must consecrate himself to God, and to God only. If the change comes suddenly and decisively by an overpowering influence, there is no further essential or lasting difficulty. The choice follows upon the thought, or is simultaneous with it, and the self-consecration follows upon the choice. The feet are already set upon the path, even if they seem at first to wander uncertainly, and even though the path itself may be only obscurely seen, and the knowledge of the goal may be imperfect. The secret teacher, the inner guide, is already at work, though he may not yet manifest himself or may not yet appear in the person of his human representative. Whatever difficulties and hesitations may ensue, they cannot eventually prevail against the power of the experience that has turned the current of the life. The call, once decisive, stands. The thing that has been born cannot eventually be stifled. even if the force of circumstances prevents a regular pursuit or a full practical self-consecration from the first. Still, the mind has taken its bent and persists and returns with an ever-increasing effect upon its leading preoccupation. There is an ineluctable persistence of the inner being, and against it, circumstances are in the end powerless, and no weakness in the nature can for long be an obstacle. But this is not always the manner of the commencement. The sadhaka is often led gradually, and there is a long space between the first turning of the mind and the full ascent of the nature to the thing towards which it turns. There may at first be only a vivid intellectual interest, a forcible attraction towards the idea, and some imperfect form of practice. Or perhaps there is an effort not favored by the whole nature, a decision or a turn imposed by an intellectual influence or dictated by personal affection and admiration for someone who is himself consecrated and devoted to the highest. In such cases, a long period of preparation may be necessary before there comes the irrevocable consecration. And, in some instances, it may not come. There may be some advance, there may be a strong effort, even much purification, and many experiences other than those that are central or supreme. But the life will either be spent in preparation, or a certain stage having been reached, the mind, pushed by an insufficient driving force, may rest content at the limit of the effort possible to it. Or there may even be a recoil to the lower life, what is called in the ordinary parlance of yoga, a fall from the path. This lapse happens because there is a defect at the very center. The intellect has been interested, the heart attracted, the will has strung itself to the effort, but the whole nature has not been taken captive by the divine. It has only acquiesced in the interest, the attraction, or the endeavor. There has been an experiment, perhaps even an eager experiment, but not a total self-giving to an imperative need of the soul or to an unforsakable ideal. Even such imperfect yoga has not been wasted, for no upward effort is made in vain. Even if it fails in the present, or arrives only at some preparatory stage or preliminary realization, it has yet determined the soul's future. But if we desire to make the most of the opportunity that this life gives us, if we wish to respond adequately to the call we have received, and to attain to the goal we have glimpsed, not merely advance a little towards it, it is essential that there should be an entire self-giving. The secret of success in yoga is to regard it not as one of the aims to be pursued in life, but as the one and only aim, not as an important part of life, but as the whole of life. And since yoga is, in its essence, a turning away from the ordinary material and animal life led by most men, or from the more mental but still limited way of living, followed by the few to a greater spiritual life, to the way divine, every part of our energies that is given to the lower existence in the spirit of that existence is a contradiction of our aim and our self-dedication. On the other hand, every energy or activity that we can convert from its allegiance to the lower and dedicate to the service of the higher, is so much gained on our road, so much taken from the powers that oppose our progress. It is the difficulty of this wholesale conversion that is the source of all the stumblings in the path of yoga. For our entire nature and its environment, all our personal and all our universal self, are full of habits and of influences that are opposed to our spiritual rebirth and work against the wholeheartedness of our endeavor. In a certain sense, we are nothing but a complex mass of mental, nervous, and physical habits held together by a few ruling ideas, desires, and associations. An amalgam of many small, self-repeating forces with a few major vibrations. What we propose in our yoga is nothing less than to break up the whole formation of our past and present, which makes up the ordinary material and mental man, and to create a new center of vision and a new universe of activities in ourselves, which shall constitute a divine humanity or a superhuman nature. The first necessity is to dissolve that central faith and vision in the mind, which concentrated on its development and satisfaction and interest in the old externalized order of things. It is imperative to exchange this surface orientation for the deeper faith and vision which see only the divine and seek only after the divine. The next need is to compel all our lower being to pay homage to this new faith and greater vision. All our nature must make an integral surrender. It must offer itself in every part and every movement to that which seems to the unregenerated sense mind so much less real than the material world and its objects. Our whole being, soul, mind, sense, heart, will, life, body, must consecrate all its energies so entirely and in such a way that it shall become a fit vehicle for the divine. This is no easy task, for everything in the world follows the fixed habit which is to it a law and resists a radical change. And no change can be more radical than the revolution attempted in the integral yoga. Everything in us has constantly to be called back to the central faith and will and vision. Every thought and impulse has to be reminded, in the language of the Upanishad, that is the divine Brahman and not this which men here adore. Every vital fiber has to be persuaded to accept an entire renunciation of all that hitherto represented to it its own existence. Mind has to cease to be mind and become brilliant with something beyond it. Life has to change into a thing vast and calm and intense and powerful that can no longer recognize its old, blind, eager, narrow self of petty impulse and desire. Even the body has to submit to a mutation and be no longer the clamorous animal or the impeding clod it now is, but become instead a conscious servant and radiant instrument and living form of the spirit. The difficulty of the task has led naturally to the pursuit of easy and trenchant solutions. It has generated and fixed deeply the tendency of religions and of schools of yoga to separate the life of the world from the inner life. The powers of this world and their actual activities, it is felt, either do not belong to God at all, or are for some obscure and puzzling cause, Maya or another, a dark contradiction of the divine truth. And on their own opposite side, the powers of the truth and their ideal activities are seen to belong to quite another plane of consciousness than that, obscure, ignorant, and perverse in its impulses and forces, on which the life of the earth is founded. There appears at once the antinomy of a bright and pure kingdom of God and a dark and impure kingdom of the devil. We feel the opposition of our crawling earthly birth and life to an exalted spiritual God consciousness. We become readily convinced of the incompatibility of life's subjection to Maya with the soul's concentration in pure Brahman existence. The easiest way is to turn away from all that belongs to the One and to retreat by a naked and precipitous ascent into the other. Thus arises the attraction and, it would seem, the necessity of the principle of exclusive concentration which plays so prominent a part in the specialized schools of yoga. For by that concentration, we can arrive through an uncompromising renunciation of the world at an entire self-consecration to the One on whom we concentrate. It is no longer incumbent on us to compel all the lower activities to the difficult recognition of a new and higher spiritualized life and train them to be its agents or executive powers. It is enough to kill or quiet them and keep at most the few energies necessary on one side for the maintenance of the body and on the other for communion with the divine. The very aim and conception of an integral yoga debar us from adopting this simple and strenuous high-pitched process. The hope of an integral transformation forbids us to take a shortcut or to make ourselves light for the race by throwing away our impedimenta. For we have set out to conquer all ourselves and the world for God. We are determined to give Him our becoming as well as our being, and not merely to bring the pure and naked spirit as a bare offering to a remote and secret divinity in a distant heaven, or abolish all we are in a holocaust to an immobile absolute. The divine that we adore is not only a remote extracosmic reality, but a half-veiled manifestation present and near to us here in the universe. Life is the field of a divine manifestation, not yet complete. Here, in life, on earth, in the body, Ihaiva, as the Upanishads insist, we have to unveil the Godhead. Here we must make its transcendent greatness, light, and sweetness real to our consciousness. Here possess and, as far as may be, express it. Life, then, we must accept in our yoga in order utterly to transmute it. We are forbidden to shrink from the difficulties that this acceptance may add to our struggle. Our compensation is that even if the path is more rugged, the effort more complex, and bafflingly arduous, yet after a certain point, we gain an immense advantage. For once our minds are reasonably fixed in the central vision, and our wills are on the whole converted to the single pursuit, life becomes our helper. Intent, vigilant, integrally conscious, we can take every detail of its forms and every incident of its movements as food for the sacrificial fire within us. Victorious in the struggle, we can compel Earth herself to be an aid towards our perfection and can enrich our realization with the booty torn from the powers that oppose us. There is another direction in which the ordinary practice of yoga arrives at a helpful but narrowing simplification which is denied to the sadhaka of the integral aim. The practice of yoga brings us face to face with the extraordinary complexity of our own being. The stimulating, but also embarrassing, multiplicity of our personality, the rich, endless confusion of nature. To the ordinary man, who lives upon his own waking surface, ignorant of the self's depths and fastnesses behind the veil, his psychological existence is fairly simple. A small but clamorous company of desires, some imperative intellectual and aesthetic cravings, some tastes, a few ruling or prominent ideas amid a great current of unconnected or ill-connected and mostly trivial thoughts, a number of more or less imperative vital needs, alternations of physical health and disease, a scattered and inconsequent succession of joys and griefs, frequent minor disturbances and vicissitudes, and rarer strong searchings and upheavals of mind or body. And through it all, nature, partly with the aid of his thought and will, partly without or in spite of it, arranging these things in some rough practical fashion, some tolerable disorderly order, this is the material of his existence. The average human being, even now, is in his inward existence as crude and undeveloped as was the bygone primitive man in his outward life. But as soon as we go deep within ourselves, and yoga means a plunge into all the multiple profundities of the soul, we find ourselves subjectively, as man in his growth has found himself objectively, surrounded by a whole complex world which we have to know and to conquer. The most disconcerting discovery is to find that every part of us, intellect, will, sense mind, nervous or desire self, the heart, the body, has each, as it were, its own complex individuality and natural formation, independent of the rest. It neither agrees with itself nor with the others, nor with the representative ego, which is the shadow cast by some central and centralizing self on our superficial ignorance. We find that we are composed not of one, but many personalities, and each has its own demands and differing nature. Our being is a roughly constituted chaos into which we have to introduce the principle of a divine order. Moreover, we find that inwardly too, no less than outwardly, we are not alone in the world. The sharp separateness of our ego was no more than a strong imposition and delusion. We do not exist in ourselves. We do not really live apart in inner privacy or solitude. Our mind is a receiving, developing, and modifying machine into which there is being constantly passed from moment to moment a ceaseless foreign flux, a streaming mass of disparate materials from above, from below, from outside. Much more than half our thoughts and feelings are not our own in the sense that they take form out of ourselves. Of hardly anything can it be said that it is truly original to our nature. A large part comes to us from others or from the environment, whether as raw material or as manufactured imports. But still more largely, they come from universal nature here or from other worlds and planes and their beings and powers and influences. For we are overtopped and environed by other planes of consciousness, mind planes, life planes, subtle matter planes, from which our life and action here are fed or fed on, pressed, dominated, made use of for the manifestation of their forms and forces. The difficulty of our separate salvation is immensely increased by this complexity and manifold openness and subjection to the in-streaming energies of the universe. Of all this, we have to take account, to deal with it, to know what is the secret stuff of our nature and its constituent and resultant motions, and to create in it all a divine center and a true harmony and luminous order. In the ordinary paths of yoga, the method used for dealing with these conflicting materials is direct and simple. One or another of the principal psychological forces in us is selected as our single means for attaining to the divine. The rest is quieted into inertia or left to starve in its smallness. The bhakta, seizing on the emotional forces of the being, the intense activities of the heart, abides concentrated in the love of God, gathered up as into a single one-pointed tongue of fire. He is indifferent to the activities of thoughts, throws behind him the importunities of the reason, cares nothing for the mind's thirst for knowledge. All the knowledge he needs is his faith and the inspirations that well up from a heart in communion with the divine. He has no use for any will to works that is not turned to the direct worship of the beloved or the service of the temple. The man of knowledge, self-confined by a deliberative choice to the force and activities of discriminative thought, finds release in the mind's hushed, inward-drawn endeavor. He concentrates on the idea of the self, succeeds by a subtle inner discernment in distinguishing its silent presence amid the veiling activities of nature, and through the perceptive idea arrives at the concrete spiritual experience. He is indifferent to the play of the emotions, deaf to the hunger call of passion, closed to the activities of life. The more blessed he, the sooner they fall away from him and leave him free, still and mute, the eternal non-doer. The body is his stumbling block. The vital functions are his enemies. If their demands can be reduced to a minimum, that is his great good fortune. The endless difficulties that arise from the environing world are dismissed by erecting firmly against them a defense of outer physical and inner spiritual solitude. Safe behind a wall of inner silence, he remains impassive and untouched by the world and by others. To be alone with oneself, or alone with the divine, to walk apart with God and his devotees, to entrench oneself in the single selfward endeavor of the mind or Godward passion of the heart, is the trend of these yogas. The problem is solved by the excision of all but the one central difficulty which pursues the one chosen motive force. Into the midst of the dividing calls of our nature, the principle of an exclusive concentration comes sovereignly to our rescue. But for the sadhaka of the integral yoga, this inner or this outer solitude can only be incidents or periods in his spiritual progress. Accepting life, he has to bear not only his own burden, but a great part of the world's burden, too, along with it, as a continuation of his own sufficiently heavy load. Therefore, his yoga has much more of the nature of a battle than others. But this is not only an individual battle, it is a collective war waged over a considerable country. He is not only to conquer in himself the forces of egoistic falsehood and disorder, but to conquer them as representatives of the same adverse and inexhaustible forces in the world. Their representative character gives them a much more obstinate capacity of resistance, an almost endless right to recurrence. Often, he finds that even after he has won persistently his own personal battle, he is still to win it over and over again in a seemingly interminable war, because his inner existence has already been so much enlarged that not only it contains his own being with its well-defined needs and experiences, but is in solidarity with the being of others, because in himself he contains the universe. Nor is the seeker of the integral fulfillment permitted to solve too arbitrarily even the conflict of his own inner members. He has to harmonize deliberate knowledge with unquestioning faith. He must conciliate the gentle soul of love with the formidable need of power. The passivity of the soul that lives content in transcendent calm has to be fused with the activity of the divine helper and the divine warrior. To him, as to all seekers of the spirit, there are offered for solution the oppositions of the reason, the clinging hold of the senses, the perturbations of the heart, the ambush of the desires, the clog of the physical body. But he has to deal in another fashion with their mutual and internal conflicts and their hindrance to his aim. For he must arrive at an infinitely more difficult perfection in the handling of all this rebel matter. Accepting them as instruments for the divine realization and manifestation, he has to convert their jangling discords, to enlighten their thick darknesses, to transfigure them separately and altogether, harmonizing them in themselves and with each other, integrally, omitting no grain or strand or vibration, leaving no iota of imperfection anywhere. An exclusive concentration, or even a succession of concentrations of that kind, can be, in his complex work, only a temporary convenience. It has to be abandoned as soon as its utility is over. An all-inclusive concentration is the difficult achievement towards which he must labor.